Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Welcome to the Faculty Book Review. In this episode, we speak with Walter E. Meyer, Professor of Property and Urban Law, Robert Ellickson, who is author of The Household, Informal Order Around the Hearth. In his new book, Professor Ellickson, a Property Law Specialist, explores the internal dynamics of the home. Professor Ellickson applies transaction cost economics, sociological theory, and legal analysis as he examines how the home is ordered. The Household illustrates how households are formed and how they choose to govern themselves. Professor Ellickson is interviewed by Caitlin Thomas, Assistant Director, Office of Public Affairs at the Yale Law School.
Welcome, Professor Ellickson. What inspired you to write this book?
This book combines two of my interests. My main teaching and scholarly field is property, in particular what used to be called real property, land and real estate. And households involve the occupation of real estate by people who live together. Another one of my major interests has been informal coordination by people through social norms as opposed to law. And I wrote a book some years ago called Order Without Law about how people in a rural area of California, in fact, solve their problems not by using lawyers or going to court, but by using informal rules. And households are, by and large, run in that kind of way. People don't consult lawyers to help them decide who washes the dishes or who controls the TV set. So I'm interested in, I think you learn more about law you can understand law better by looking at areas where law is not important and then helps you appreciate why law is important in some arenas but not in others.
Who is this book written for? Who is your intended audience?
It's a, perhaps if I were to identify a group of academics who might be especially interested is people who call themselves institutional economists, people interested in how people set up permanent associations with one another to carry out some activity. So a lot of these people are interested, particularly historically, in the structure of business enterprise. And very much overlooked is the structure of domestic enterprise, if you will. And so my book fits in very closely with theirs. One of the early scholars, this is about as good a name as there is to drop, who was interested in the household is Aristotle, who wrote in his famous work, The Politics. He starts off with a section on the organization of households in ancient Greece. And his conception is, the state is built from households to villages to the state and whatever. And so he appreciated that households were a very important form of organization. And my sense is that they are.
And can you explain a little bit about what the difference is between a household, a family, and a marriage relationship?
These are three very commonly used words. People often use them as synonyms. I make a significant effort in the book to try to make people think about that these actually refer to different social arrangements. The reason they are often used as synonyms is that these relationships often overlap. But let me start with family. A family, blood relatives are determined by biology. You have no control over who's in your family tree. It's just given to you. Certain important family relationships, however, you choose, and those are, interestingly, very much regulated by the state. Those are marriage partners and adopted children. And the state cares a lot about who you're married to and what happens when you end your marriage, so you have to get lawyers, for example, to divorce or to adopt children normally. And a lot of those rules are about, designed to make sure that children are protected in their lives. So that's a very legalized kind of relationship. However, households, you don't need lawyers to start and stop. And most of us will live in 20 different, I don't know, Caitlin, how many households you've lived in your time, but most of us will in our lives live in dozens of different households. And we are very adept at establishing them and ending them and whatever. And we don't need lawyers to help us do that. We don't need a license from the state. There is no official document saying that we started our household and we've ended our household. As an example, most people think that married couples have to be in the same household, but in the United States, about 7% of married couples, in fact, don't live together. So that's an example of where the household functions somewhat differently. many Yale Law students and are in households, but they are not family households. They live with a roommate or whatever. And that's a form, a significant form of relationship, but it's not a family relationship and it's not a marriage relationship. It is a household relationship. So I define as a household as a place-based arrangement where people generate domestic services like meals, shelter, care for one another. And all of us spend about half, you know, half or more of our time in these places. About economists who've tried to measure this estimate that about one third of domestic production occurs in the household. 200 years ago, it might have been 90% of domestic of economic production occurred in households. So these are very, very important units of social organization and production. And a lot of this is sort of off the books. It doesn't appear. The value of your services to the household, or not, you don't have to report as income on your tax returns.
You write at length about the consorting with intimate strategy of ordering a household. Can you explain a bit about the advantages of this model? What makes it so successful as a means of ordering a household?
Well, this is based. I have a lot of empirical work in the report on a lot of empirical work in the book, drawing on what sociologists and historians and demographers have found about how people live. So, lawyers pay very little attention to the household, but these kinds of social scientists write a tremendous amount about it. So we know a lot about how people actually live. As you know, as we all know from our own lives, is people tend to live in small households. Most of the median size of a household in the United States is now less than three, and it's about half the size of what it was even a century ago. So people tend to keep their numbers small. And one of the reasons, I claim, is that the success of your home arrangements are so important for the quality of your life that it's very important that it go well. And therefore, you want to structure it in a way that it's likely to go well. And the smaller the number of people involved, the easier it will be to organize it. So you tend to keep the numbers down. And small households tend to work better than larger ones. And we can talk more about that later. Similarly, you want to associate with people who are likely to be cooperative with you and for whom you don't have to write out fancy contracts and consult with lawyers about how you're going to make arrangements around the house. So to improve your chances of having a successful relationship, you not only want to keep your numbers down, but you want to associate with people who are likely to be disposed to cooperate with you and to engage in what I call gift exchange, where one person voluntarily does the dishes and the other person voluntarily takes out the garbage or whatever. You don't have to talk a lot about this. It just sort of happens through informal exchange. And generally speaking, it's best to live with to take advantage of people who are blood relatives of yours as one arrangement. Another is to live with people who you're likely to have a long-term future relationship with. So that is likely to make them less like fly-by-nights and more inclined to cooperate with you. So if you're a Yale Law student, if you come to New Haven and you're looking for a roommate, you, without thinking a lot about it, know that it will be advantageous to live with another Yale law student, not just because you'll be able to study together and talk about law, but actually you'll have a more successful time getting the dishes washed if you set it up that way. And similarly, for a lot of people, the natural choices are to live with relatives or marriage partners, and that's what most households are structured. Keeping the numbers down to show you how dramatic this is that in the United States, of the people who don't live in family households, that is, don't live with either a spouse or children, 68% of them choose to live alone today. That they're so hard to coordinate that they don't live with anybody else. The number living alone is three times the number living in doubles. But again, to show you how people perceive numbers as a problem, the number living in doubles is four times the number of people living in triples in non-family households. So if you're a Yale law student, you kind of have learned through life that living with one, it's hard enough living with one person, living with two is to be avoided. And so you really keep the numbers down and consort with intimates. This applies to owners as well. And one of the major things I try to do in this book is to indicate that to have a successful domestic enterprise, you not only need what I call labor to do the job, the work around the house. But you also need capital to finance the operation of the house, in particular to buy, if you're living in an owned situation, to buy the structure where you live. And owner groups can be different than occupant groups. That is, you might have A and B may own something, but it's occupied by A, C, D, and E, or something like that. So they don't necessarily overlap. And among owners, you have exactly the same pattern, is that people, when they buy together and to finance a household, try to keep the numbers down and to consort with tenants again. So in the United States, 95% of single family houses are owned by either a single person or by a married couple. It would be very unusual if you're thinking about doing something together to invest with a relative stranger in owning a house. Similarly, if you look, I was able to gather the data on this. Rental buildings, in New Haven we have lots and lots of 2 to 4 family houses and whatever. Those are overwhelmingly owned by either single individuals or by married couples, that you have the same pattern. You don't have large corporations or partnerships with large numbers of people owning even small apartment buildings, but to a surprising extent, the same is true for big apartment buildings. So people understand keeping numbers down, consorting with tenants. Life is simpler. You don't need lawyers quite so much. This is all quite subversive to the practice of law, because I'm studying the areas that work without lawyers, but I think lawyers appreciate their role more better if they understand the parts of life where they're not important. That helps them understand why they are important in the areas where they are important.
In your book, The Household, you use historical sources to compare traditional family-based households and more complex arrangements, such as those in medieval English castles and communal living arrangements. What did you find these types of households have in common, and what type of households prove the most successful?
Well, historically, there have been gigantic households where people were not intimate at all. So the most interesting that I discussed, some of the most interesting, are medieval castles where there might be as many as 500 people living behind the walls of the castle and sharing meals together to some extent in a common dining hall. Another more recent example are the kibbutzim of Israel, where you had idealistic founders of communities before the State of Israel was established, who sometimes would live by the hundreds, and they would share dining arrangements as well. And one of my theses here is that more work, this is consistent with Ronald Coase's famous work on the theory of the firm, is that you have, when organizing things, you have a choice with doing things within the firm, in this my example, within the household, or dealing with outsiders. And when it's harder to deal with outsiders, because the world is very perilous, as it was for the early Israeli settlers of the kibbutzim, or in the Middle Ages, where things were very, very dangerous on the countryside, people transact more within each other within the household, and larger households make sense. The kibbutz movement, which I describe at quite a little length in the book, is in deep decline. The tradition of having meals together, for example, has been abolished at many kibbutzim, and there's been a lot of privatization there. And that's consistent with my theory that outside conditions matter, as Israel has become a safer place to live and so forth, that this advantage of the kibbutz declined. There are other reasons. The ideological fervor declined. They did not have success in creating the new man and so forth that they wanted to create through the, so there, you know, it's a complicated story. These very large households tend to work best where there's a strong religious faith that unites the members. Most kibbutzim were not religious institutions, but there are famous examples of Benedictine monks, for example, of Hutterite settlements in the Great Plains of North America, where you have successful long-term households with dozens of members who eat communally and share a great deal. I described them at some length. Interestingly, in utopian theory, when people think about a better world, their dreams are not about a better state. Many people here at the law school are very concerned about the organization of the state. Utopian literature is largely about a better household. It's about how to have a better home life. And that goes all the way back to Plato and the Republic, about the guardian class lives in a different kind of way. It goes to Thomas More, and his famous book Utopia was about people living in large numbers in certain kinds of housing. So and all lots of utopian movements are sort of back to nature communes and so forth, or about organizing domestic life in a different way. So that's interesting that this is what people's the utopian literature tends to push. Most of these experiments with these different kinds of communities, as I say, are very hard to sustain. They don't last very long, particularly if they don't have a strong religious basis to help sustain it.
Given the mortgage crisis and the huge numbers of foreclosures today, the very concept of a home and a household have been turned upside down for many Americans. Is this a type of a historical moment in which we as a society will have our definition of household redefined in some way?
My guess is we might see a slight decline in the percentage of Americans who own their homes. That's been drifting upward. It was less than half a century ago. It's drifted upward to about 68%. It might fall back a couple of percentage points or something like that, depending how deep this crisis is. But the household is one of the most enduring of institutions known to people. It's been around for thousands and thousands of years. The trends I'm talking about are very, very, very basic. And even this very severe mortgage meltdown is a mere blip in the longer trend of things that these households will be around. One thing that seems to be clear is that as people get wealthier, they value privacy more and more. And that you might think it's a lot of fun to live with lots and lots of other people. That's what these utopian dreams are about. In fact, what happens when people get wealthier is they seem to value their privacy and they're more likely to live alone. So to this amazing extent today, people, once they're widowed or widowered or whatever, you might think they would go off and live in a be attracted to live in congregate housing of some sort or live with their children or whatever, and to an amazing extent they prefer to live alone. Younger people prefer to live alone. Of course, now with these new technologies, with their cell phones and whatever, you can live alone and have quite a vibrant set of social connections at the same time that may have something to do with it. Let me raise another issue, which is connected to the mortgage meltdown, which is the role of capital in the household. This is one of the things that I stress. It's a kind of a technical point, but it's quite important in the theory of enterprise. Henry Hansman on our faculty has done a lot of work in this vein, and here I'm following the theory of Oliver Williamson, who was on this faculty at some point, some decades ago. And that's that when you run an enterprise like a household or a business, the most vulnerable of inputs are the people who put up the money. Because once they put up the money, other people involved with the business can snatch it in various kinds of ways. So an enterprise also needs labor, but it's hard in a world where there's no slavery to snatch labor. So labor is a less vulnerable input. And so this Williamsonian insight suggests why in a business the people who provide capital actually have a lot of special powers on the board of directors and whatever. It's because they're so vulnerable that if you don't give them that kind of control, they won't provide the capital. So in the household, I claim, the same thing is true, and the same pattern, which many people associate with the rise of business, I claim was discovered by our ancestors hundreds of generations ago when they put together their households, that the people who put up the capital to buy a house, for example, should have special powers there. So an example I give in the book is I have a multi-person household where there's a middle-aged woman and who lives with her older father. And she wants to bring in a dog. I don't know if you had the pleasure of having a dog in a house, but a dog is actually changes the nature of a house for the better or worse. That's a big event in a house. And so then the question is, can she bring in the dog? And I claim it depends who owns the house. And I've checked this with other people who face these kinds of decisions, and they agree with my intuition. That is, if it's her house because she's put up the money to buy it, it's a no-brainer, she can bring in the dog. If, however, she does not put up the capital, it's her father's house, She has to get his approval because a dog actually can make the house much less valuable, do damage to it, make it much less valuable to live there. So that this rule that people who provide money have special powers is one that is honored around the household just as the same way that's honored around the business corporation. And I claim actually a lot of our business institutions grew from the kernel of the household that people understood from their domestic life, and that, as I said, 200 years ago, almost all of enterprise of any kind was organized around the hearth, and then the large business corporations that we have are to some degree outgrowths of this little kernel. I would say that the final point is that this institution, though little discussed by lawyers and institutional economists, is sort of a very important kernel in social organization and is somewhat different than marriage and deserves its attention unto itself.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to a podcast by the Yale Law School.